Okay, as Neil said, the marriage between the MRI and MHD turbulence and radiation effects in disks is one that involves quite a large group of people over quite a span of years, at least 7 or 8 years at this point and running. What I want to tell you about today is a particular branch of that effort in which the principal participants were myself, Shigenobu Hirose, and Jim Stone. And I should particularly mention Shigenobu because, in fact, he did the lion's share of the hard work. Now, to introduce this, I want to step back a little bit, way back to the beginning. Some of this material that Neil has already gone over, and this essentially falls into line with one of the challenges that Mitch gave us on Monday morning, if you can remember back that far. The basic story of how disks work, as we think we now understand it, is that there's a magnetorotational instability that underlies the driving of turbulence, and then through shear that leads to correlated magnetic fields and stresses the transport angular momentum, and thence to inflow. And this has been studied in a great many papers and a great many calculations for a long time. And all of that successful program is shown in green on this slide. That's up to here, John. Just wanted to be helpful. The portion shown in red, these last three lines, has received far less attention to date, and yet it's the last part of the story that we need to understand in order to understand the light that comes to us and made these objects interesting in the first place. Now, in addition to that basic question of explaining what we actually see, the thermodynamics of disks are important for internal dynamical reasons as well. For a start, most of the dynamical work so far has made the assumption that the equation of state, the determination of the local pressure, is simply a matter of an adiabatic gas law modified occasionally when there's entropy created in association with shocks. This is not a complete description of the pressure. There is genuine dissipative heating. There are genuine radiative losses. And of course, the pressure is the key quantity in determining such things as support against gravity, the support of compressive wave modes, and so on. It's also of interest in discussing the sort of overall heat flow in the disk to look at its fluctuations, because one of the generic properties of all these accretion systems is that they do tend to have variable light curves. And we'd like to understand how the dynamics of inflow, all the turbulence which runs more or less on the orbital time scale, is perhaps filtered through such processes as dissipation and photon diffusion to create the sorts of power spectra that determine the level of fluctuations and the time scale distribution of fluctuations in the light curves. Lastly, there are the details of actually predicting the spectrum. You need to know where the heat is deposited and the details of structure of the atmosphere in order to do a proper atmosphere stellar sort of calculation to find to what degree the local quasi-thermal spectrum is genuinely a Planckian, or to what degree there are departures and there are interestingly non-black body features. Over and above that, one of the zeroth order predictions of classical accretion disks is, of course, the thermal spectrum and the way the temperature of the inner rings should scale with luminosity relative to Eddington and central mass. That zeroth order prediction is one of the few that's really vindicated by observations in the scaling from the 10 eV scene in AGN to the 1 kilovolt scene on galactic binaries. But there's a major missing part, which is that in all these systems, some interesting fraction that varies with spectral state, as we've spent a lot of time talking about, goes into hard X-rays, produced by some material at clearly much higher temperature than any of these quasi-thermal regions in the disk. And to understand where that comes from, we need to know how heat is dumped in regions of low density, low optical depth, so that you might have a hope of producing temperatures high enough to make X-rays. Okay. So where we're headed in this program then is first to better understand the equation of state, the basic pressure structure in these accretion flows. Secondly, radiation forces. Neil told you a few minutes ago, a very strong prediction of the Shakura-Sanyaev description of disks is that the inner regions of bright accretion disks should in general be dominated in terms of their support against vertical gravity by radiation forces. And that means that the region where most of the light is produced in the brightest, most interesting disks should be dominated by radiation forces, and we need to know how to incorporate them in these models. As Neil also told you, you can see these are very closely allied projects here. There are questions about the stability of the thermal balance in the radiation-dominated regime. And in fact, part of the motivation for what I'm going to tell you about today was that in our initial exploration of the radiation-dominated regime, some questions arose about the quality of the thermal equilibrium, and we wanted to have a clear place to start from, a sort of smooth place to stand on before tackling the harder problem of thermal stability in the radiation-dominated case. So what we decided to do was to go back and essentially improve the numerical quality of what we were doing. This, we began with a code with the Zeus heritage. And as John explained to you earlier, these codes conserve entropy primarily, do not conserve total energy. And so what we needed to do, because of course energy conservation is essential to understanding thermodynamics, we needed to recast it more in the vein of a total energy solving simulation. The tack that we took was simply to solve an auxiliary total energy equation, or almost total energy, which monitors the magnetic energy and the kinetic energy in each cell and at each time step, and when energy would be lost for a variety of numerical reasons, it is instead locally captured into internal energy, that is, into heat, in that cell. And the curve here shows the fractional departure between the energy in the box in the simulation I'm going to discuss and the energy that should be there, and we know how much energy should be there because we know how much work is done on the box and what it started with, as a function of time. This is over a span of some 60 orbits. And as you can see, that fractional departure comes down to around, drops a little bit to about 0.06, but that's 0.06%, not 0.06. So to a fairly high accuracy, I think that goal was achieved.
How much would that be lost
in raw numbers? Oh, in raw numbers? In ergs? Oh, okay. Essentially, the way to think about this is that for the conditions of the simulation, the cooling time was about 11 orbits. So this is roughly 5.5 cooling times. And so this is dissipating and radiating the entire thermal content of the box roughly 5.5 times and losing 0.06% in the process. Okay?
But what you haven't shown us is how much of the energy you had to recapture while you were doing that.
Oh, but that's the whole thing. That's basically all of that is recaptured. Okay. It would be off scale. The path of energy is that work is done on the box, that goes into turbulence and magnetic field and kinetic energy, and then that is dissipated. But that's the whole point. Okay. And lastly, the loss of photons is, as Neil described, done by a flux-limited diffusion procedure. So the simplest is, in fact, gas pressure domination, because it was not expected to entail any of the questions of stability that the radiation pressure case does. This particular example is not a global disk, it's a shearing box. The units of H there, just to set a scale, are defined by the isothermal scale height at the initial effective temperature due to gas pressure alone. We chose these particular parameters so that the opacity could be simply described. It's dominated, well, in this case, we took it to be exclusively Thompson scattering and free-free, suitably thermally averaged for the two of them. That's an underestimate, perhaps by a factor of few, compared to what you would have with a solar abundance mixture and at these conditions, in full opacities. Okay, the initial condition was chosen on the basis of a guessed Shakura Sinyaev-style equilibrium with an alpha of 0.03. Really, all that does is it fixes the surface density. Now, first I wanted to demonstrate to you that it really does relax efficiently to a steady state. You can see there's the flux leaving the box. There's a transient that lasts a little bit less than 10 orbits. And from then on, the flux bobbles around, but it's more or less in a statistical steady state. The cooling time in this, as I mentioned before, is a little more than 11 orbits in the sense of total energy in the box divided by the mean flux. This is what it looks like, and these curves look a lot like the ones that you saw a few minutes ago. Over here, the density profile, the dashed line is the initial condition, the classic Gaussian isothermal equilibrium, and relative to that, this time average, which is average over the last 50 orbits of the simulation, so during the time when it was in a reasonable steady state, is extended out at large altitude. The reason it's extended, you can see over here. The dashed dot curve is gas pressure. The dotted curve is radiation. The solid is magnetic. So from roughly this point onward, from about 3H out, the support is primarily magnetic. The field is generated and that was amplified by the MRI. It's buoyant relative to the gas and floats up and provides the dominant pressure extending the material of the disk out at these altitudes. And in fact, those profile curves are not just reminiscent of what Neil showed you a couple of minutes ago. They're actually very reminiscent of what Jim Stone and Kristen Miller would have shown you 5 years ago, because they did the analogous sort of pre-thermodynamic calculation. That is to say, a vertically stratified shearing box under the influence of the MRI. The difference in their case was that they assumed an equation of state that was isothermal, gamma equals 1. Their density profile is very similar. Their support up here was likewise magnetic, and the transition took, and in fact, even the scales are about the same. Pardon? That will come in a moment. One slide more. Okay. First, I want to show you something that Miller and Stone could not have shown you because they didn't consider radiation quantities, and so they couldn't say where the photosphere would be. Because we are calculating the radiation diffusion, we have to know where the photosphere is. The flux-limited diffusion procedure involves estimating an effective Eddington factor. That's a third in the highly diffusive regime. That's this light blue color in here, and then increases when you go towards the photosphere. Just as a fiducial marker, we define the photosphere as Eddington factor of a half. That's the gray color here. And what I'm showing is a particular vertical slice in the YZ plane at a particular time. The position of the photosphere fluctuates with time, but it's generally in the range 6.5 to occasionally going out of the box at 8H. I took this particular time when it was well in, basically so you could see the structure above the photosphere. But here's the temperature profile that Daniel requested, and this is the initial state, this is the time average. As you can see in the body of the disk, the thermodynamic equilibrium is very well achieved. T gas equals, the solid curve is T gas, the dotted is T radiation, and they lie very, very close together. Starting at about 4H, they start to depart in the general sense that the gas temperature is 20 or 30% higher than the radiation temperature. What this amounts to, remember the photosphere, as I said, is somewhere 6 or 7 out here, is that there's a kind of extended thermalizing photosphere. This is the scattering photosphere. The thermalization photosphere you might define as someplace in a little ways. This rise at the surface is likely spurious, if you've discounted. Now, where that energy comes from is, as I said, effective dissipation. The time average of the dissipation is the solid curve. The time average of the stress is the dotted. They're very similar. They're very closely related. Now, to zeroth order, one way to describe this is that it's almost a square wave between plus or minus 3H, and then very little out at larger distances from the midplane. But you can also see that there are definitely wiggles on this, even after the averaging over roughly 5 cooling times. You can also see there's a distinct asymmetry over that time averaging. And that asymmetry will be a recurring theme. You can see it here in the time average fluxes as well. Solid curve radiation diffusion flux, dash dot pointing, the dash here, gas convective. The energy is carried to the surface overwhelmingly by radiation diffusion. At its greatest, the pointing flux is perhaps 5 or 10% of the radiation diffusion. And that's probably a fairly general state of affairs. Here's another view of the asymmetries. This is a log scale of the magnetic field intensity, and you can see that there are significant times when the upper half has stronger field than the lower half. And these last, remember the cooling time is about 10 or 11 orbits, these last four periods of order the cooling time. There's the dissipation on a linear scale, just contrast enhancing, it shows the extent of the asymmetry. And one thing that illustrates is that even over times as long as the cooling time, the disk is not necessarily in the mean state. There are long time scale departures from the mean. The reason that the dissipation is concentrated in the middle plus or minus 3H is seen here. That's the region where essentially gas pressure is greater than the magnetic. The gas can act on the field and twist and pull it around. Here, where the magnetic pressure is stronger, the field structure is much smoother. There's much less opportunity for dissipation. Again, emphasizing a point that Neil remarked on already, if you ask about time relationships between the emergent flux and the dissipation, you might expect that there would be typically a lag of order the cooling time. Well, that's a reasonable zeroth order averaged order of magnitude estimate. But in fact, if we look at this cross-correlation, which peaks at about 1 or 2 orbits, that's about a tenth of the mean cooling time. The reason is that much of the dissipation takes place at relatively great altitude where the photon diffusion time is short. And in fact, in terms of the variance of the dissipation, it's actually somewhat disproportionately at the outer layers where the dissipation is strong, enhancing this effect. Okay. Now, what does this mean? Well, the first is that we have an indication here that when this sort of profile is passed through this sort of detailed atmospheric calculation of code like the one Ivan Hubany has written and that probably 4 or 5 of us in this room have worked with, that we might expect significant departures from Planckian spectra because there's an extended, relatively low density region around the photosphere. The second is this point about the response time to fluctuations in the heating. I'd mentioned earlier that to understand the fluctuations in the light curve, you might imagine in a sort of in a formal, you know, electrical engineering sort of approach, taking the power spectrum of, so let's say, stress fluctuations, and passing it through a low-pass filter whose critical frequency was 1 over the cooling time. Well, in fact, the pass band is likely to be rather broader because the cooling time that counts is not the mean one all the way from the midplane. A different kind of moment that takes greater account of high altitude regions that from which photons can diffuse more quickly. Last point is that in this calculation, we saw very little dissipation at high altitude in what you might think would be the corona where you'd look for hard X-rays to be generated. So that raises the question of, you know, given that we do see these very hot regions, where they are located. They don't see this gas pressure dominated outer region does not seem to be a good candidate for locating that corona. And, you know, one might hope that regions at smaller radius would be more fruitful in producing that sort of those sorts of high temperatures. Probably a good place to stop.
Magnetic dissipation in this.
In by what mechanism?
Yes. What okay. In your code.
Okay. It is essentially a numerical effect. That is to say, when you watch pointing flux into a cell and it does not result in the proper field strength, it is assumed that there has been an effective grid-created dissipation of field, and the energy is counted and re-described as heat.
So do you think perhaps that the question of why the corona doesn't do much, doesn't look like a good site for radiating, might be traceable to what the physics of the magnetic dissipation might be?
Well, as a first guess about where you think true dissipation would occur, I would expect that in fact the places with sharp gradients and where numerical effects would lead to field loss would in fact be the first places you'd look. A smooth, steady place, I would think, would be a less likely candidate. No?
That's
push my buttons. I'm a little disappointed to see that so many years after Miller and Stone, we're still doing simulations which extend only in the radial direction, only 1 or 2 vertical scale heights. I think that compromises all of the fundamental the conclusions that are drawn about the corona. First of all, the ultimate source of energy in all of the simulations is the shear. And the kinetic energy in the shear is proportional to the square of the radial extent of the box. So by limiting yourself to 2h in the radial direction, you drastically limit what's available. Secondly, as you've shown, above some altitude, both the stress and the dissipation become magnetically dominated. If you think about the magnetic geometry, because you've limited yourself to 2h in the radial direction, if loops are to extend beyond 2h in the vertical direction, they become, you know, they become very non-semicircular. They're enormously elongated, would have to be enormously elongated z compared to the distance between foot points. So, I mean, I think very probably the reason that you don't see much dissipation beyond 2h, vertical, beyond 3h, is because your radial box is not larger than 2h. Until you do simulations at 2, 3, 4 times the radial extent, keeping the other dimensions constant, I won't trust those conclusions.
Well, I think the best response is first to defer to the people in the room who've done more conventional shearing box calculations than I have, and perhaps have experience that can directly answer that. But second, also to remark that the field structures seen in the truly global simulations did not seem that dramatically different from those seen in these relatively narrow shearing boxes. Yes. I think I'd like to hear John's comment on doing shearing boxes like that.
Big shearing
boxes? Yeah, the sort Jeremy is suggesting.
I would be reluctant to do it with Zeus, but I think we can do it with Athena, which is the new code for those who are not in the name game. As far as the question about the corona, I think it is the case that the shearing box gives you a sort of a artificially quiet corona. But on the other hand, the global simulations, there's a lot going on up there, but it tends to be more like outflowing wind rather than sort of a picture of field loops anchored at different radii. I don't know that anybody's seen anything that looks quite like that.
Larger field
below density.
Is that
an observation or a conjecture?
So your region is, the regions are excellent, but in radial direction, it's restricted. In nature, when matter comes from outside, magnetic energy increases faster than matter energy. And finally, you will get in the region where magnetic energy is larger than in your simulation. So what if you add magnetic field into the disk, and also you'll decrease density in corona, if it's possible, then you might see more buoyancy of magnetic field in the disk up and expansion of loop. I think this is
okay. That's a conjecture.
If things are controlled by the MRI, you could also argue, although this is also a conjecture, that theta never is much different from n one to this. So arguments about that's arguments from MRI. Again, that's also
that many calculations that clearly need to be done, including one of them clearly here is something that's MRI unstable, but it's also fit with net flux from outside, magnetic flux from outside. It'd be very interesting to know who wins in that illustration. Daniel, you had some.
Yeah, I was just wondering how sensitive the outcome is to your numerical parameters, like your flux limiter and so on.
We have not done really any experimentation with the form of the flux limiter. It's something that I think should be done. I'm a little doubtful that it would have much effect on these results because, as you saw, the great majority of the problem area is in fact thoroughly in the diffusive limit. And I doubt that the details of the shape of the photosphere will make much difference globally.
Okay, let me ask a connected question. What do you do with the magnetic field boundary condition at the upper edge of the simulations? Can the field escape?
Okay. The field can escape. In practice, it doesn't. Pointing flux out the top of the box averages essentially to zero. And the technical outer boundary condition is free-streaming projection of the electric field, EMF, or the constrained transport algorithm. And then there is a small amount of artificial resistivity in the ghost cells on the outside in order to maintain smoothness.
Daniel?
hear when we study stellar atmospheres and interiors that opacity is a very important element. The changes of opacity with height or density. I understand that current simulations do not have those changes incorporated, but can you make any comment about that?
Okay.
Let's say that this is 10 years from now.
Well, that's what we deliberately chose these parameters so that the opacity would be relatively simple. Yeah. And if we used genuine opacity project numbers, the opacity would typically increase by factors of several, but I don't think in any particularly dramatic or, you know, systematic fashion. If we chose disk parameters with a lower surface temperature, not of order 10 to the 6K, but closer to the ones you were interested in, of the, you know, 10 to 4-ish, then those line opacities would certainly be of interest, and that's one of the reasons we chose not to, you know, we wanted the simpler case first. It's not convective anywhere. And that depends on the run of dissipation.
Nobody else? Okay, let's thank Julian and everybody.